Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, the podcast that is dedicated towards bridging the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Thank you so much for taking the ride with me and with us. As you all know, I usually do a end of the month wrap up, or at least I try to do an end of the month wrap up. This month of May 2020, I mean, it's as if 2020 could not be any worse. The month of May has just been an absolute disaster when it comes to law enforcement. There's so many different stories that we could talk about. We could talk about the botched search warrant raid in Kentucky. We could talk about the seeming discrepancy between how the New York City Police Department was enforcing their social distancing amongst African Americans, and in contrast that to how they were treating the white citizens. So there's so many different stories that we can talk about. And of course, the major stories are Ahmaud Arbery and, of course, this newest, most recent one, George Floyd up in Minnesota. So listen, we're going to get into it, and I've got a great guest along to come along with me on this ride for today as we do our monthly wrap up. Her name is Miss Diane Goldstein. We met at a conference in Missouri back in the fall of 2019. I had a great time speaking with her, very knowledgeable lady, and she was so kind enough to come on the podcast and lend a little bit of her wisdom and experience into what's going on with law enforcement and this divide that we were trying to shrink down that is only continue to blow up and exacerbate and get so much worse. A bit about Miss Diane Goldstein. She is a 21-year veteran of law enforcement who served as the first female lieutenant for the Redondo Beach, California Police Department. She's a speaker and chair for the Law Enforcement Action Partnership, a group of criminal justice professionals that work advancing justice in public safety solutions. She is a guest columnist for many media publications and recognizes the subject matter expert in criminal justice and drug policy, appearing on television and radio as a political commentator. She wrote an article concerning the Ahmaud Arbery case called "Ahmaud Arbery Case: Deep Investigation Must Take on Structural Racism." So she wrote that particular article for Filter Magazine, which is an online magazine. And so we reached out, talked to each other, and I'm so glad she wanted to come on the podcast. I really appreciate it. And so this is going to be our monthly wrap up. We're going to take a look at some of the major stories for the month of May 2020. And make sure that you rate, subscribe, and share this podcast with your family and with your friends. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is the interview with Ms. Diane Goldstein, a member of the organization LEAP. So like I said, I just kind of want to talk about, this crazy, this month of May has been unreal.
It's a show like I haven't seen in quite a long time. And, you know, well, and we can get into this, but, you know, in 2016, I wrote an article that got reprinted in Vice News called "Why a White Cop Supports Black Lives Matter." Mm. And it was after the Dallas Police Department shooting. Mm. And it was after, you know, Philando Castile, and, you know, it just blew everything up. And this is the exact same feeling I'm getting, but there's some interesting things that, you know, we can talk about and elicit, because I know you're on Twitter, is different than it was 4 years ago when I got lambasted for talking about how a cop could support Black Lives Matter. Now you're seeing police chiefs, active duty police officers. I even just went to Police One, which I still belong to, and can look at the comments. Even the cops, after seeing the video, are saying there is nothing defensible about this. This is a horrific thing, and these guys deserve to lose their job. So we're making progress, but we're stepping so far. I mean, things are changing, and then someone does something stupid, and it calls the whole entire profession into question.
Yeah, yeah. I absolutely agree. I absolutely, absolutely agree. So why don't we jump into it? So I want to welcome you to the show, Diane Goldstein. We met at the LEAP conference. It wasn't even a LEAP conference. It was the drug reform conference by
Drug Policy Alliance.
Yeah, Drug Policy Alliance. I don't even know who it was. I know I had a good time when I was there down in Missouri, and it was a good time, and we met there, and I still have your card around here somewhere, so I didn't forget about you. I still have your card. Thanks for coming to Captain Hunter's podcast. I really, really appreciate it. And even though I read your bio to the audience there, would you just mind just telling us about yourself and how you've been staying safe in these COVID-19 times and all kind of stuff?
So my name's Diane Goldstein. I'm a 21-plus year retired police professional. I retired as a lieutenant and was a division commander for a couple years in Redondo Beach Police Department in California. And currently I'm the chair of the Law Enforcement Action Partnership. I've been with LEAP since 2010 when I started as a speaker around the issue of drug policy reform. I had my older brother that brought me to advocacy work because he died from a drug overdose. Back in 2007, and during the process of his entire life, there were various points where he was involved in the criminal justice system that significantly impacted him in really horrific ways, including before he died. And so sometimes it takes personal experience to change people's viewpoints. You know, policing experience on the street, I always had a different viewpoint about what our role was, but I never really understood when I dealt with folks who had been impacted so severely by the criminal justice system, what it really meant, until I saw my brother experience some of the issues that he did around drug law enforcement in particular, which included perjury on a police report, where I let him languish in custody for like 2 or 3 months, didn't believe him. And it was a radical, life-changing event for me to see the criminal justice system in its entirety through the lens of someone who was victimized by it. And it changed my viewpoint pretty dramatically. And I didn't know about LEAP back in 2007, and just happened to be at a debate during the original marijuana legalization campaign in California in 2010, where there was one of the judges that was a speaker for LEAP that was debating a police chief. And I went up and introduced myself, and I got pulled into the LEAP family. Life-affirming work. And I look at what you do, what I do, what all the active duty criminal justice professionals that belong to our organization do, is we are the people that understand the system, and we are the people that have the ability to change it. And if we can't change it, law enforcement is going to end. And it should end as we know it, but it's going to change in a way that is going to be detrimental to our communities. If we don't change it, you know, if law enforcement doesn't take the Floyd George death really to heart and say something has got to be done, because what I'm seeing, and I know you're pretty active on Twitter, you know, and I don't know if you've ever really worked or read a lot of the work by abolitionists. There's abolitionists who literally are preaching to abolish the police. And incidents like this further their message, because there are people now that I have worked with in the past. There are people who I follow on Twitter that would never talk about abolishing the police, who are now talking about abolishing the police. And so, you know, we know that that's not likely to occur in the future, you know, we know, we understand our experience has to be focused on how we quickly change law enforcement. We can no longer, you know, accept these incremental steps. We have to start really talking about how law enforcement needs to be changed completely in its entirety. Training, you know, sanctity of life, unions, their leadership. There's so many things that are intermixed in this. And we have to work with communities of color that we have marginalized for years. And be the people, because we're in the position of power, to be the ones to go forward and say, we need you, the community that we're supposed to serve, to help us change policing for the better. And we can't do it without them. I think in the past, we've been trying to do it without the proper input and the help. And, you know, we can take the death of George and do something positive so his death is not meaningless. Does that make sense? I mean, it's, you know, there's so, this month has been, you know, Ahmaud Arbery, you have, you know, Louisville Police Department with that horrific no-knock raid that killed Breonna. You have the COVID-19 race disparities in policing in New York. You have this. You have, you know, Ahmaud Arbery that was literally executed in a modern-day lynching. And I'm frustrated because I don't know how to push reform and how to blow up the system any faster than we're doing right now.
Yeah, you touched on a lot of things that I really want to get into. And one of the articles, let's just kind of start at this top here, is one of the articles that you wrote. It's in Filter magazine, right? That's the name of that magazine.
Correct.
I'm an Arbery case. Deep investigation must take on structural racism. If you would, I know so many people, you talk about pushback. So many people talk about structural racism is not a thing. What is that? Can you define it? You know, could you put your finger on it? Can you define that for us? What do you mean when you say structural racism?
Sure. So when I look at the entire structure of our government system, and what people tend to forget is that there were baked in racism and policies based on racism that started, you know, hundreds of years ago. And very specifically, let's take a look at drug policy. So my master's degree is in the intersection of kind of public health, policing, and race. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember, and, you know, today's modern day police officers are never taught this. They don't understand what structural racism is all our drug laws were designed around minorities. Cocaine laws, African-American, marijuana was Hispanic, you know, opium and heroin were the Chinese. And those baked in law, the baked in racism in those laws continue to pervade today, because what we do is what without intentionally being racist. And I think that this is the thing that law enforcement doesn't understand. This is what in my master's course, I think, was very critical, because I had a bunch of active duty police officers from across the country at UC Irvine in a master's policy program called Crime and Justice System. It was out of the School of Social Ecology. We fought about this, what is structural racism? And police officers don't understand, because they've never been taught the history. They've never been taught the redlining of real estate and segregation and how that developed, you know, and pushing African-Americans into particular sections into an urban environment. You know, we don't talk about the school systems or the lack of job training or the economic opportunities. We don't talk about poverty, you know, and law enforcement thinks that it's just about the laws, and they don't understand the big macro world and how policy is enacted. I mean, and you can just go in and look at whether it's academic research or the press and media and how and very specifically in drug enforcement, is how we stereotype people. You know, you think about the white opioid suburban environment that for the first time, we weren't stigmatizing drug users because we treated them as victims. You know, you had white kids from the suburbs who got addicted to pain medication, and they weren't stigmatized as a criminal, you know. But if you go into the African American community or the Hispanic community and see the same description of a black kid or a brown kid who had the same issue happen to them and they're arrested, they're stigmatized, they're criminalized, they are othered. And so, you know, all of us, I mean, I've been called a racist significant number of times in my career. And it took me a long time to not take it personally and to really look at the issues and then really to be insightful about law enforcement. I mean, I started in 1983, I retired in 2004. In the 1980s, I had lieutenants who were telling us, which all of us ignored because we were smarter than the lieutenants back then, that if there was a black male that was in our city, that they need to be stopped just because he was black. And so, you know, we were able to call out, you know, that bad behavior simply by ignoring them. But and making certain that when we were out in the field, we weren't doing that. But no one called into question back then that this white lieutenant had the form and the ability to say that without any consequences to his actions. You know, whether, you know, it's deliberate racism or implicit bias, it doesn't matter. That's what creates a structural racism system. It is baked in into the system. And until we eliminate a lot of the laws that allow things to happen and reduce the contacts with people in general, things aren't going to change. I think the importance of drug legalization simply at this point for me is it eliminates probable cause for an officer to stop someone on the street. It forces them to have to go back and do policing and not just, you know, do lazy policing. It, you know, it is drug policing allows us to violate people's rights. And we violate people's rights in communities of color much more than we do in white suburban communities that have economic resources.
When you, you know, this talks about the, a lot of the differences that people have. And I think you know, life experiences and all that kind of stuff. So when I told people when I was a police officer, or when I, or even now when I tell people that I used to be a police officer, you know, if I was talking to someone who was white, they would say, oh yeah, you know, my uncle used to be a cop, and he was a cop in the '80s and the '70s and this, that, and the other. And, you know, and that you would think that it forms some type of bond, right? Okay. You know, I'm doing the same job that your uncle or father, stepfather, whoever did. But always in the back of my mind, because I'm a person of color, I always think exactly about what you said. What did those people tell? Was your uncle that you're so proud of one of those people who was stopping my uncles, my cousins, my nephew? You know, and so that shows the dichotomy of the different life experiences that people have. And I'm certainly appreciative of law enforcement and the place that it's allowed me to go. But that's always something that's in my mind is that different life experience. When somebody tells me, oh, I used to be a cop. But once again, in the back of my mind is, did you stop us? Did you think this about black males? Did you plant drugs, evidence, or whatever? You know, right. And it's really just disappointing. And I think as we mentioned, this is coming to a head at this point in this time because of cell phone cameras. I want to continue with this Arbery situation in the structural racism type of thing, because I think that the Arbery situation really shows and sheds a serious light on the structural racism, right? So you gave us a good analogy about the drug laws and how they were set up to suppress, detain, harass, you know, people of color. So we get Arbery, And so we see the actual, not just the police officers in and of themselves performing, or not just the citizens doing certain things because they didn't think there were any consequences. But then yep. we see the police who, I guess the Gwinn County Police Department has been under investigation. Their chief has now been suspended or fired or whatever's going on with that. And we get the district attorney, a couple of district attorneys who had to recuse themselves. And so this is what we are saying when we talk about structures, right?
Yep.
We get citizens who think that it can act with autonomy. We get police officers who are backing up or refusing to arrest. We get district attorneys who are now saying we're not going to do something. And in other cases, we get judges. So I kind of blabbed about that, but I want to interview you. Tell me what your thoughts are about that.
And that's exactly, I mean, the Arbery case was the perfect example. And, you know, some of the things that came out after the article were very, very interesting is the house that was under construction, the owner ended up sending a video clip to, I believe it was the police chief of Gwinn County, and said, "Hey, what do I do about this?" Okay. I don't believe it was a video clip of Mr. Arbery of Ahmed. I can't remember who was a video clip. So there were multiple people walking onto his property. Okay. And it didn't become an issue until it was a black person. You know, so the police chief, I believe it was the police chief or someone in the police department directed him back to the suspects and said, "The next time that happens, call these guys." And so instead, it's like, well, why would you do that? Why would you create a system of vigilantes? You basically gave the suspect's permission to do this. And so, you know, so the structural issues, you know, for me, you know, is I blame the cops should have had some moxie. And that's the nicest word I'll use because there's a better word for it. If I was the supervisor on that scene as a sergeant and as a lieutenant, I would have made sure those guys went to jail that day and then let the DA refuse to prosecute or release them. It would have been a no-brainer. There was a cold-blooded murder. They had the videotape from the beginning. Those guys should have been in custody, in jail at that moment. If the DA then basically says, "We're not going to prosecute, we want more, we want to further the investigation." Things happen. I understand that. But for the DA, for the two DAs to do what they did shows their complicity in protecting one of their own. And very clearly, the second DA in particular, who then wrote the defense, is stunning to me. It is absolutely stunning to me. And that's the perfect description of baked in structural, that they neglected to do their job, because all our jobs should be to do justice. And that's to exonerate people if the facts aren't there. It's to ensure that victims' rights are protected. And every DA who talks about victims' rights and doesn't support a victim like Ahmed Arbery is in fact supporting structural racism. And that's the baked in things that people don't understand. I'll give you a perfect example. So years ago, I had a case. So I worked a gang unit and I ran our gang unit. And we had a case of a kid who we helped get out of the gang. He moved out of the city. Things are going great. A few years later, I mean, he had gone through juvenile probation camp and everything else. A few years later, the gang shows up at his doorstep and they push their way in on the allegations of being friends. And this one particular gang member ends up threatening Travis, and Travis panics and kills him with a shotgun. And the suspect had this really, really long history of violence. And we went to the DA to try to help the suspect in this case to say, hey, look, there's mitigating circumstances. Let me explain the whole situation. And I remember the DA basically saying, our job is about convicting people and it's not about anything else. And we don't care what your opinion is of this. This is what we're going to do. And he went, he got 15 years to life. So he got 15 years for a second degree murder and then a 5-year enhancement for firearm at age 19. And so those are the things that when we talk about baked into the system, is that what is the role of the DA? It's not just to convict people, it's to do justice. You know, what's the role of law enforcement? It's not just to convict people, it's to do justice. It's to be fact finders and be about the truth. And so, you know, as we continue to redefine what the criminal justice system is going to be in the future, we are going to have to implement things like restorative justice. We're going to have to change the dynamics of how we charge people. We're going to have to change how, you know, the criminal justice system treats marginalized people who can't afford fines. You know, we have debtor's prison. We have a two-tiered system of justice right now in our country. And it's absolutely appalling. And it's based on economic resources and money and whiteness in many aspects.
Yeah, that's well said and very disappointing. What's involved in the investigation? That was part of the title. What's involved in investigating this?
Well, I think a big part of the issue is we have to set up some type of system like, you know, the National Transportation Board does. We have to have the ability, whether it's at a local level, a state level, or a federal level, where we need a criminal justice equivalent of the National Transportation Board that comes in into these types of situations and does a critical and thorough assessment of everything that went wrong and how to prevent it happening in the future. And then we need to follow up. Do we need legislative changes? Do we need policy changes? You know, what is involved in this type of situation? And you know, yes, you know, it is once the videotape was released to the public unintentionally by an attorney who thought the guys were completely justified in killing Ahmaud Arbery.
I don't know what was wrong with that attorney. Like, what's wrong? Yeah, you were paid for that?
But you know what? That's okay. We'll take it. You saw a professional law enforcement response that within 24 hours, those guys were in custody. There was and then they continued the investigation. They saw the videotape of Ahmaud Arbery in the construction site doing nothing more than having a drink. And I can tell you, you know, it's funny, I completely appear white. I was born in Mexico City. And so culturally I'm Mexican. And so, but because I present as white, I'm judged much differently. You know, I can't begin to tell you, you know, in many aspects, that's part of my privilege, you know, in law enforcement, you know, is people would make comments about people of Latino culture, and I'd have to pop up and say, I'm Mexican, and what you just said is completely inappropriate. And it would be, you know, and so it's, you know, that taught me a lot about kind of stigma and implicit bias and how law enforcement, you know, can view people that aren't necessarily look like them. And, you know, it just becomes one of these things that we got to change. You know, it's hard because how do we how do we identify biases given all the rigor in getting hired, at least in California? You know, I don't know how it is in other places. I imagine it's a lot less of a rigorous standard. But how do we get rid of bad police officers? How do we get rid of bad prosecutors? You know, how do we prop up good police? And I think that's really an important question here. And you know, on part of the good news that came out of, if there is any, you know, that came out of George Floyd's death, is the police chiefs and the police officers who are making very public statements against the officers who did this, who are basically talking about how the firing was completely appropriate, who are basically looking at the incident and saying, this is shameful that this occurred, and it's going to set us back with the people we're supposed to serve and protect. That is the only bit of good news that years ago, people would not, I don't think, had the courage to say this. And I think, you know, our organization that you're a speaker for, Larry, is giving people that are criminal justice professionals, you know, the backup to be able to dissent and say, we can't have this anymore. People have to be held accountable. The system has to change. We have to do a better job of educating our officers and our DAs of what structural racism is or isn't, and how we can better serve our community and our stakeholders. And I think part of it is redefining what public safety means. I try to use more of a holistic term. I use community health and safety, because that makes every single person, no matter what their economic resources are, whether they're homeless or live in a $1 million mansion, stakeholders in defining what community health and safety should be. It's not just the cop's job. It's not just the DA's job. And I think we need to continue to wrest power from them. And we need, and that, I mean, I think, you know, legislatively, we need to call out unions. We need to call out racism. You know, we need to call out people like Bill Barr, and the, you know, the joke of the new presidential commission on policing.
It is a joke.
You know, it is, you know, his statements that people, if they don't respect the cops, don't deserve law enforcement protection. It, you know, but again, the good news is you have law enforcement professionals and leaders pushing back against that type of rhetoric. And that's what's changed. And it's not changing fast enough. I'm incredibly frustrated by the lack of movement forward, but it is changing. And maybe this death will get us pushing forward in a much faster way.
I certainly hope so, and I'm in agreement with everything you just said. I like what you said about the National Traffic and Safety Bureau. I had Michael Bell. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. Michael Bell was an Air Force colonel. He retired a colonel, but when he was a major, he lived in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And when he was a major in the Air Force, his son was tragically killed by the Kenosha, Wisconsin Police Department.
Yes, I know that story.
Yes, yes, yes. And so he was one of the first ones to push for this national traffic safety type of bureau for law enforcement, because he was completely dissatisfied with the investigation. Within hours of the actual killing, the DA and the chief of police had said that the killing was okay. They hadn't even collected all the evidence and all that kind of stuff. So he was on a podcast. He pushed for a lot of different changes. And so I just want to kind of bring the audience up to speed about that. And I agree that we need some type of overarching, independent type of investigative force, union, agency, whatever, to come in anytime there's police shootings and really do an investigation. And we certainly need district attorneys who aren't writing defensive recusal letters. And listen, I've never been to law school a day in my life, but I read that and I'm like, I can't believe that this, what this man is writing. I can't believe what this man is writing.
You know? Well, and he had the videotape. I mean, this is the thing. This is so hard because, you know, we compartmentalize law enforcement and pain and things that you see all the time. When you see someone die, you know, it's a pretty horrific thing. Whether it's, you know, fatal traffic accidents or child abuse investigations, you know, I've had friends that have killed themselves. It's trauma really makes you think about things differently. And for these DAs to ignore that trauma to the victim's family, I tried not to put out that video on social media because it was so horrific, because I can't even imagine being the mother of Ahmed, because I have a son who's 29. I have one. And that if something like that happened to him, and to see his death on television and in the media like that, you can't ever erase that. To not be able to protect your child. And for that DA to ignore evidence. And that's why the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, man, they got called in. As soon as they got called in, boom. That's how things should happen. That's how we do justice. There was never a question, never a doubt. And, you know, for Americans like, you know, Candace Owens and the, as I call them, the race grifters, or Tommy Lahren, you know, or folks like that who continue to perpetuate those stigmas about people of color is stunning to me. That people like that are allowed a platform. I get it. You know, it's, you know, that people in America still buy into their ideology. Says a lot about America. I mean, this mom from, you know, the racial disparities in COVID-19, in New York, to see what was the stat, like 340 plus citations and like 304, or it was like 304 citations and, you know, like 300 were black and there was one white person.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, COVID-19 policing right now is drug war policing. It's the exact same principle. It is that legislators don't understand the impact of unintended consequences of good intentioned laws. You know, drug laws were racist and then they became good intentioned laws in the 1980s and the 1990s. But make no mistake, even under Ronald Reagan, it was about black people and crack. And not white people who use cocaine and, you know, the Wall Street. You know, we all lived through the 1980s in policing. It was all about black people. And even a good intention law gives us as cops the right to kill people. And so before, we need less laws, not more laws. We needed lots and lots of masks. So when there was a social distancing issue in the subway, what those cops should have been doing is handing masks out to people. You know, did you see the videotape of the Philadelphia bus where an African-American, got on the bus, didn't have a mask. There's a sign says, you know, no mask, you know, you can't be on the bus. So the cops get called. There's like 10 of them that are dragging this guy out. And it looked, again, horrific. Horrific, horrific, horrific. Why didn't someone just, why wasn't the bus driver equipped with masks when someone walked on? Hey, here's your mask. Can you please do me a favor? This is the new rule. You know, in over in Europe, I was watching a videotape of Spanish police officers who were down in their subway system, and people were coming in without masks. They were handing them a mask. They were handing them a mask. And that's the difference between being peace officers and mindlessly policing people.
So what's the reason for that? Is it this country's too big? I mean, people have made, you know, those same analogies concerning Norway, Netherlands, Switzerland, Spain, whatever. I mean, those countries are, you know, whatever, 60, 80 million people. We have 330 or whatever we have million. Is it the size, or is it just, this is about Black people? This is about control of Black people.
I think it's a combination. Honestly, I think it's both. And it's how our system was set up. I mean, think back to trespass laws or vagrancy laws. Mm-hmm. And you know, in England, vagrancy laws started with the peasants. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. You know, you can go back and look at historical research, and then the Magna Carta came in, and that's one of the reasons why the Magna Carta came in. But, you know, vagrancy laws in the United States were set up because of Black people. We had sundown. I was in California, and I grew up in Redondo Beach, Torrance, and then lived in Orange County before we moved here. Orange County, California had probably some of the most significant sundown laws. People are like, what are sundown laws? Well, sundown laws were basically that if you were Black or Hispanic in Orange County, you had to be out of that town or in your house by sundown. Not for white people. You know, you look at our history with the Ku Klux Klan, you look at so much of almost all the laws that we've created, not all of them, but some significant ones, are created as an easy way to maintain order and not deal with systemic issues in our society. So, you know, I always talk about budgets. And it's a weird thing to bring into, you know, this conversation about civil rights and human rights and how we police people. But I always try to tell people that if you go into our government and you look at individual cities' budgets are a moral argument. When we budget for police more than we budget for education or for mental health, or for job training, or for after-school programs, or for drug treatment on demand, we're shortchanging programs that do more to reduce crime. And if we're really concerned about public safety, is all those other programs would be budgeted at the same place that law enforcement or the fire service was. And that's the other part of this issue that we're not talking about right now. Oh, we're starting to have conversations about it. Interesting enough, I think it was Durham, North Carolina. I just read an article, and I'll send it to you. And it was the article, the title of the article, "Now's the Time to Defund Policing During the Pandemic." That's roughly.
You know, I saw that title. I didn't read the article, but I did see the title. Yeah.
Read the article. It's actually and it speaks to the abolition movement. Okay. Mm-hmm. People are really upset and angry, and they want to abolish the police department. Well, there are cities right now where you have citizens group who are making the argument that no, we shouldn't fund more police officers. We need to effectively fund these other programs. And you know what? I can't disagree with what they're doing. And I hate the abolish the police conversation, because it's not an all or nothing. Okay, it's just like, you know, it's when I wrote this article in Vice 4 years ago, it's not mutually exclusive to support Black Lives Matter and to support the proper role of policing and what it should be. We can have both if we basically agree that we need to sit down and have conversations and understand that we in law enforcement, we in government have held the position of power, so it's up to us to make the first move. If I was a police chief, I would be meeting with organizations like that and say, I absolutely support funding more money into your programs. How do we do this effectively so we maintain community health and safety and well-being? Let us work with you as a partner instead of the budget fights that you have.
What were your thoughts when you first saw the George Floyd video? Tell us what went through your mind when you saw that.
Disgusted. It's overwhelmingly shocking that these officers were either so poorly trained to look at that video, and there was a point where he went limp. This didn't need to happen. Why are you sitting with your knee on someone's neck for 9 minutes? Four minutes after he died? You saw the urine puddle. I hate to even talk in these terms, but it's shocking. And that's and it can't be defended in any way, shape, or form. And interesting enough, I haven't, the Fraternal Order of Police, the National Fraternal Order of Police that normally is coming out and saying, really incendiary things about, Black Lives Matter and what's going on in our community. Even they've been silent, except for the local union who said, let's wait till all the facts come out. And everyone I know that's viewed the video says there are no facts that need to come out. This is it.
Yeah.
The police chiefs are saying this, officers I know are saying that it's, you cannot view that video from a law enforcement perspective and say there is anything that supports and justifies what happened there. It's a potential forgery. It's a misdemeanor, maybe. How often do you have felony forgery charges? We used to have a bad check section. It's about the same thing. And it's how we do policing in areas that are marginalized. If that was a white homeless man, in Beverly Hills, would it happen? I don't know. I just see this as officers poorly trained, out of control. The one officer I think is now, we know, has a history of complaints that none of them were sustained. So it's, again, when you start talking about systemic issues, is why today with technology do we not have early warning systems implemented in every police agency when it comes to use of force or complaints? I'm sure you were a suspect in NIA at various times in I was, but I think about, I go back and I look at my IA complaints. They were all about me being, you know, chippy. You know, I had one lady who complained that I invaded her personal space.
Yeah.
You know, and citizens do complain, and citizens do make false complaints. But there's a large bit of truth that you can define if you have an officer that is consistently being complained about. You have an issue and you have a problem and you need to look at it and deal with it. You either, you know, have an officer that shouldn't be a police officer, or you have a poorly trained police officer and you have a lack of supervision.
Yeah, I think that's a good assessment. And I think that's exactly what I think happened. You talked about the policing in these particular types or parts of town areas. Four officers show up for a forgery complaint. Is that not a waste of resources in and of itself? You know, I asked you, and I'm going to tell you that after the watching, and I did a video dissecting the Arbery case, it really took a lot of energy and effort for me to sit there and watch. And I couldn't watch all the whole video. I think as soon as he went limp, I was done. You know, as soon as he started calling out for his mother, I was like, oh. What is this? What am I watching here? You know, I just can't. Is this reconcilable? You talked about many chiefs who are saying that this has set us back. Can we fix this?
In my heart, our organization, LEAP, exists because we know it can be reconciled, but it's going to take some significant work and some significant funding, and it's going to take an honest assessment by many police officers, and that's the hard thing. You know, it is... I've written lots of articles, especially around the issue of drug law policing. And in particular, you know, you go to listservs that are private for police officers and you see some friggin' horrible things that are being said. I mean, like, I've literally had to, I just dumped my Facebook account. I'm off Facebook. I said, I can't anymore. And a big part of it was the politics and some of the police groups that I belong to.
Yeah. Yeah.
That I just can't even respond. It's like, you know, what are we doing? Do you guys honestly believe this? Are you so ingrained in that law enforcement bubble that you don't understand the big world? And I think that's a big part of it. You know, education is a huge issue. I think the thing that was so satisfying to me after getting my master's, we had a cohort of like 60, 70 of us from across the country. There was probably about 14 of us. I was the only retired member of law enforcement. Everyone else was, you know, from the FBI to California law enforcement. And in the beginning, the active duty guys, so there was a Black African-American FBI agent who used to be a teacher who's actually stationed out here in Las Vegas. And I need to reconnect with him because he's just a really sharp guy. And we started talking about these issues of structural racism. And I would sit there and talk about disparities in drug law enforcement and the need for sensible regulation and how it undermined all Americans, you know, constitutional rights, you know, why we marginalize people, and that you didn't have to intentionally be racist to participate in a system that supports structural racism. And I think that's part of this very, very hard conversation to have, that just like the abolish the police conversation, is we have cops on one end, criminal justice professionals on one end, and we have people that have been victimized by the system on the other end. And people are incredibly emotional and deserve to be incredibly emotional on the victim's side, which I believe are the people that we've marginalized and have suffered under the brunt of the criminal justice system. And then you have the cops who feel targeted as well. You know, the whole war on cops, the whole, you know, I had a guy who was who's a PhD, he's a former San Jose police officer that found me on LinkedIn a few years after I wrote that article on why I supported Black Lives Matter, that wanted to send me his book on why Black Lives Matter organization is a terrorist organization.
He wrote a book about that?
Yeah. I'll get you his name
I want to talk to this guy.
And I just said, you know what? I'm not even engaging. I just didn't even engage him because I just ignored it because there's no winning there. I'll send you the information, but he's very smart and it's really interesting. He just wrote an article on that was sent to me on policing during this pandemic and how police officers have taken an oath, you know, to prop up people's constitutional rights and pandemic policing goes against it. And the person who sent it to me, who's friends with him, I said, well, why don't you ask him about if this only applies to white people or black people? Because he's saying the complete opposite when it comes to drug law enforcement and to, you know, protests and to shootings, you know, that law enforcement has had that have impacted people in such a negative fashion. I mean, he's one of those guys.
He sounds like one of those guys that will be defensive of white males running into the Michigan Capitol with guns. But if Colin Kaepernick wants to take a knee during the national anthem, then he's got a problem with that. White males can't get haircuts and want to go back to work. That's a real problem. We need to stand up and protest.
Yeah.
But when we get knees put on our neck and we get choked out, that's we got to be quiet about that. Okay.
Yeah.
I definitely want to talk to this guy.
Yeah. I'll send you the information. Yeah. And actually, you know what? Maybe we can have all three of us on the podcast.
We can do it.
Yeah. You're willing to talk. And interesting, he's also kind of a forensic force expert. So he's always defending cops and officer involved shooting.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely like to. Listen, I don't claim to have that much expertise, but yeah. I was an instructor for 3 years in defensive tactics. So
yeah,
we can go at it a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's the whole thing is law enforcement just doesn't want to be insightful and are intransigent about this issue. And so the beauty of the master's program was at the end of the 2 years of us working together. And even though it was an in-person and an online program we had like 80 hours together during the 2 years you started hearing folks who were active duty officers talk about structural racism. And understanding the difference between being a racist. You know, if you're a police officer and you belong to the Ku Klux Klan and you hold white supremacist belief, you're a friggin' racist, shouldn't be allowed in law enforcement. If you're a police officer that doesn't understand what structural racism is, and if we could do a better job of educating our officers in an academic setting, in an academy setting, to bring in stakeholders from the community to talk about, you know, the advent of laws and why they still have an impact in communities of color. I work narcotics. I didn't know a thing about prohibition era laws. And, you know, until I came to work into LEAP and started doing academic research and went, oh my goodness, in the congressional record, you have white congressmen in the early 1900s that are calling people racist names.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a big, huge part of this issue is that we're unwilling to educate law enforcement, really treat it as a profession. You know,
is it law enforcement? Is it refusing to, or is it just white people in general don't know their history or enough history?
I think it's both. It is a combination. You know, we talk about trying to professionalize law enforcement. You know, in California, I attended a 4.5 month academy that was 1600 hours. To be a cosmetologist or an esthetician or a barber, it requires almost, you know, double, if not three times the amount of hours to cut someone's hair. You know, law enforcement shouldn't be like that. It's like, okay, we're going to give you a basic academy, but then we're going to demand that you go back and get a real education, not just an academy education. And I think that, because what I saw from the officers, because I didn't finish off my degree until my 50s, my bachelor's degree. Life got in the way. I had almost my bachelor's degree, finally went back to school, got my master's degree. But what I found, even both as a sergeant and as a lieutenant, and as an officer, is the better educated the officers were that I worked with, for the most part, okay? There was like two eras of officers. There was the Vietnam-style officers that I worked with that were the least racist, most community policing-orientated officers. And then there were my peers that were absolute jerks sometimes. And then we had some really educated officers who had both the street experience and the education to put the policy pieces together to really work on policing as a profession. If we want policing to change, we have to treat it as a profession. And we don't necessarily at this point. I don't know how changing, you know, do we require people to have bachelor's degrees like the FBI does, you know, is, but that eliminates a lot of good people that are police officers. I mean, when I got hired, there's these balances. How do we encourage that? How do we make certain that our officers are educated in the right environment and not just in the police environment? You know, because every time there was a new law that was passed and we were forced to train our own, everybody just rolled their eyes. And this is just some, you know, when racial profiling law got passed in California, is we did the training and it was worthless. Yeah. We didn't bring in stakeholders. We didn't bring in people that were impacted. We didn't, you know, we didn't really adopt and believe in the change in the policy. So it was doomed to fail.
Talk about, I want to, I don't want to hold you too long here.
No, it's fine. We're good.
Okay. So talk about your thoughts about the what went wrong with the Louisville, Breonna Taylor. Here's another systematic racist part about it. And from my perspective is that the officers then arrest her boyfriend who shoots back, which is like salt in the wound, insult to injury. You all mess up. You know you messed up. And then you're going to charge someone with murder. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, isn't that the first thing? Think back on how we were trained, that if you lay hands on someone, they got to go to jail, right?
Right.
That's that old school mentality of not looking at, oh my God, what went wrong? You know, that's having that Sentinel and TSB type of, you know, lack of supervision is, you know, and you know, from some of the things that I've also read, that they're now calling into question the probable cause on the search warrant that actually got him into the no-knock search warrant. So, you know, there is no doubt that I think one of the single biggest policy failures that our country has been involved in has been drug law enforcement.
Yeah.
Simple, period, end of story. It has it changed the dynamics of policing. It created a mentality of the war on drugs, which it's not. It's a war on people. And it's a war on people that are much different than we are. And it set up policing for profit. that you know, we were so hungry to get and stop these big cartels that were seizing people's property and violating their constitutional rights. And everything that was involved in that case from beginning to end was wrong. It's if you don't have procedures set up for search warrants, and they already had the suspect in custody, which is,
you know that.
they had the suspect in custody. And so they believed, as I recall, that this apartment was being used and that this guy was somehow tied to them. So they didn't do their job. They didn't, and people were critical about, well, he's in custody, why do you have another search warrant? I ran a career criminal narcotics unit. It's like, we've taken people outside their homes and then gone back and done a search warrant. But you had to have a nexus. This guy didn't even live there. And so what I always love is, so let's go back to Philando Castile, the NRA. How many guns have you taken off people? I've had guns pointed at me where I didn't shoot someone.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes back to lack of training, lack of supervision. It goes back to the demonization, of the difference between how the media and politicians and law enforcement has portrayed black criminality versus white innocence. Okay. You have, the real conservative groups, whether it's Heather McDonald who does work, I think it's the Hudson Institute or the Heritage Foundation, I can't remember which one she's with, that always talks about black and black crime.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to having her on one day, but go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, it's just she just misconstrues and the lack of context in the stats. She's the one that wrote the book, The War on Cops.
Right, yeah.
There is no war on cops.
There isn't.
Right now is law enforcement has the least amount of deaths that we've had in years. We're having more COVID deaths than officer involved, shooting deaths where they've been gunned down. But from beginning to end, I just blame drug prohibition, drug law enforcement, the emphasis on drug crimes, which disproportionately falls on people of color, lazy policing. They didn't do their job. They may have perjured themselves on an affidavit. And if they did, they should be criminally prosecuted for that. And then I blame organizations like the NRA that don't really support African Americans and their rights to own and bear guns, who demonize black people, who didn't do a thing for Philando. I was hoping, Philando Castile, here we go. Let's have this discussion about the Second Amendment, because I don't want to take people's guns away. But why are we not defending the rights of African Americans to own guns? Do you think if the Michigan protests were all Black Matter Lives protesters walking into that Capitol slung with guns and rifles, what do you think would have happened?
Listen, it would have been ugly. It would have been ugly.
Yeah.
And the NRA would not have would have had something to say about that. That's not what we want. You can't protest at the Capitol. They would have said all kind of ridiculous, foolish nonsense.
Yeah. So I was very happy to see that the DA dropped the murder charge against the victim, because he's victimized as well. What are we doing going into someone's house on a no-knock warrant at 2:00 in the morning? There is not a drug case in the world that is worth risking our officers' lives. And so let's have that other conversation. Drug law enforcement risks officers' lives needlessly. And if we really want to talk, about, what we're doing, why are we sending our guys in to risk their lives for a policy that has been shown to be neither efficient or effective? All we do is play drug war whack-a-mole. That's it. Boom. It's never gonna end.
Right.
Why do we endanger people? And then when we make a mistake, why do we try to cover it up with the criminal prosecution? Here, I'll share a story. I was a sergeant, and I was running our narcotics unit, but I was also managing our peer counseling program and our crisis negotiations unit. So I have a big background kind of in critical incident management and some other stuff. So I'm home, it's a Sunday night, and I get a call from my lieutenant, who basically says, "Hey, I need you into the station. I need you to probably, pack some extra clothes because you're going to be there for a long time. And I need you to call every peer counselor in the department and get them to the police station right now." I'm like, holy shit, what happened? The only thing I could think of is that we had an officer killed. Did we have an officer killed? He goes, "No, we didn't, but we killed someone that we shouldn't have." And it was like, wow. So rolled the station, call all the peer counselors. And what had happened is we had a parolee who had just been released from prison, who had immediately absconded from prison. From his parole, never went to his parole agent, was an alcoholic, stole a car, and did a hit and run in our city. So we find the car, comes back, it's stolen, and we have our officers in pursuit out of our city and now going through Hermosa Beach, Manhattan Beach, El Segundo, and then past LAX airport into LAPD jurisdiction. And we spike strip, doesn't stop the guy. They can't pit him because there's too many cars around. Finally, the tires go flat at the other side of LAX in Westchester. Helicopters, we have way too many police officers there because you know how pursuits go. We have every other law enforcement agency's got police officers there. Literally, the scene is an absolute mess. And sergeant's there. Guy's refusing to get out of the car, so they pepperball the car, and the guy exits out of the car. But he's still refusing to come back. And so we had just implemented less than lethal shotguns. But our range staff, in their wisdom back then, didn't want the bad guys to know that they were less than lethal, so they didn't put the bright yellow stock on them. They just wrapped reflective tape at the end of the shotgun. So now it's graveyard. We're on the other side of LAX. You have lights and sirens on every car going. You have a helicopter. You have a massive, typical situation that is really messed up. So the sergeant calls for less lethal. You got two of our officers that are standing next to each other. One of them is holding a shotgun. One officer goes, "Less lethal." The one officer who's holding the shotgun swears in the noise that he said, "No shotgun." When the officer takes the shotgun, thinking it's a less lethal shotgun, goes up, deploys what he thinks is a less lethal, and shoots our suspect in the chest. Suspect goes down and dies immediately. This is in front of 20, 25 police officers, helicopter. It was a horrible, horrible scene. The officer who killed the suspect is really religious. He goes into a meltdown when he realizes what happens. they have to place him into the back of the police car because he's already threatening suicide. He's devastated. So now we have all the graveyard that's out there, shouldn't have been. So now, so we're assigning peer counselors to everybody. So brand new police chief, he's been on our agency for a week, maybe 2 weeks. And everyone's in and we're sitting there and I'm the only, the investigative sergeant, me running the peer counseling program, the lieutenant and the captains and the chief. And they basically say, you need to do everything you can to make certain that our officer is healthy and we're going to figure this thing out. And what we did immediately is did an internal assessment that said, our mistake, our bad. This was a horrible policy failure because we should have had the yellow shotgun stock on it. We immediately called the press. LAPD came in, did the investigation. You know, we had critical incident debriefings. We had peer counseling. This officer was off work for 6 months. We had to take his guns away, but we saved him. We saved him. He came back. He's still a sergeant on the agency right now. And we, without having to be sued, without having bad press, we got a hold of the press, who was our local contact, who always worked with us, and said, we're going to give you everything. We're not going to hide a thing. The community supported us. Within a month, we gave the victim's family $1 million. We did it an internal Sentinel event and recognized what we did. We said we were sorry.
I think that getting in front of it and taking responsibility and transparency is all that anyone has ever wanted. All that anyone has ever wanted. Just be transparent. Don't lie in reports and try to cover things up. You make a mistake, you make a mistake. And some things, as you mentioned, that story tells about a mistake. It was an accident. It was a poor policy. So take ownership of it. And so I think that's what it is. I'm going to let you go here. I got two more questions for you.
Sure.
I want to talk about the opposition, right? And I'm going to include abolishing the police in that. Talk about the Tommy Lawrence, the Candace Owens. Why do these people do this kind of foolishness? Why do they speak up the Fraternal Order of Police when they say crazy things? And also tie this in. I know this is a long kind of question, but tie this into Eric Garner, right? If Eric Garner, I was on I just released an episode with a friend of mine who's a pastor in Minneapolis. And so I said on his, he did a Facebook Live and I was on there with him. And so I said, listen, if Eric Garner and Daniel Pantaleo, the officer in that case, would have been convicted, I almost guarantee that this situation wouldn't have happened because that would have sent shockwaves and ripples through the minds of every law enforcement officer that anyone anytime says they can't breathe. You get a different response. But because Pantaleo got off, because it was refusal, again, by the structural racist system, all the way up to including AG Barr's Justice Department, refusing to indict, this caused this whole cascade of events. So please talk about the opposition, Fraternal Order of Police, the NYPD union, and all that kind of stuff.
You know, here's the hard part, because we belong to unions as we grew up in our organizations. And I'm a real union supporter if we stuck to wages and working conditions. But instead, what unions have become is they've become lobbying arms of law enforcement. And so they're no longer serving. I mean, they're serving their purpose, but what they also don't understand is every time they protect a bad cop, it causes these issues. I don't understand why we just don't say, you know what, there's an investigation. Critically, there is nothing more than you can do. But instead, what unions have done, they've done it very successfully, is they have bartered in memorandums of understanding, you know, heightened police officer Bill of Rights. There is going to be so difficult to dismantle how we hold police accountable because of law enforcement MOUs and unions. And so, you know, it is when a lot of the abolish the police people are talking about trying to legislatively take away the ability for law enforcement to have unions. And I don't know how that's going to go, because here's the issue is, you know, I've had this mantra for a long time around the criminal justice system. You know, the police outside of the military in the United States are the only people that are allowed to kill people. That's it. Okay. Just us. Nope. You know, no one else can legally, I mean, citizens can, don't get me wrong, but you know what I mean by that. And we always fall back onto our job is not to make the laws. How often have you heard it? It's just to enforce the laws. And that's BS. Because if that was true, you wouldn't see the millions of dollars spent by police unions, by fraternal orders of police organizations, by professional law enforcement organizations, including district attorneys or police chiefs, that have a heavy presence inside legislature. And so until law enforcement gets out of the lobbying business, I'm going to continue to oppose and point out the hypocrisy of the unions. And I understand, again, how the abolish the police folks have a lot of rights to say what they're saying, because the power system is unbalanced. You know, it is, the unions are simply trying to protect their own political self-entrenched interests, and they're not serving their constituents and their communities. And if they were, if they at least acknowledged it, then maybe there'd be a place to start, but they won't. Instead, they protect the bad cops, just like they protect good cops. And so, you know, I saw in our organization, and I'm sure you did in yours, where you had supervisors who intentionally targeted people and tried to get them fired for no reason. And then I also saw the flip side, that we couldn't get rid of bad police officers because of the union.
Right. Yep. I saw both. Yep. You're right.
You know, so there's those issues. But what I'm not going to do is ever back down from calling out the political nastiness of the FOPs, like the New York Sergeants Benevolent Association. They're absolutely one of the worst, as is the Fraternal Order of Police out of Philadelphia. You look at their leadership, and their leadership is predominantly white and old, protecting their own self-entrenched interests, who refuse to acknowledge the baked-in racism in the system, and instead, you know, don't care because they can't get fired and they're getting paid a lot of money. And I think that's the thing that's appalling to me as a taxpayer, you know, is we directly fund law enforcement and indirectly fund law enforcement union dues. Okay. Our money, our taxpayer dollars, is being used to undermine policy and reform that needs to be implemented simply purely for political self-entrenched interests. And so until I try not to make this political, but, you know, because I'm kind of like, I'm all over the place relative to politics. You know, I support, you know, Medicare for all, but I'm also a fiscal conservative in some other areas. You know,
an independent thinker. I think it's crazy. I think it's crazy just to be a Republican. You agree with every Republican thing? You agree with every Democratic idea? It's foolish.
Yeah, it's completely foolish. You know, but until the Republicans start calling out law enforcement unions, I'm going to play the union card on them. And that, and again, that's the thing. It's like, how did we allow these organizations to get to this place? In California, the folks that drive me crazy on top of the police unions is the District Attorneys Association, who basically is, you know, every reform that we've made in California is at risk of being lost because of their organization and cops who are playing the tough on crime. Oh, look at what No Bail has done with COVID-19. We can't arrest people. Right. You know, they are literally perpetuating. They're waiting for the next Willie Horton.
Right.
And they're using that for their own purpose. And so, you know, I don't agree with a large segment of what, you know, the abolish the police people want, but there's some significant things in there that I agree that need to happen and should happen.
I know I said I got to let you go. It's been almost an hour and a half here. I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you so much for coming on. Just finish up by telling us, where do we go from here? How do we fix this? I know I asked this before. Are we too far gone? Give us your words of wisdom of how we can get on the road to recovery here.
I think it's incumbent upon us as career law enforcement professionals to be the people to go into communities that we have hurt and marginalized and say, I'm willing to listen because I know we've made tons of mistakes and we don't want to see this continue. What can we do to help? Like, we need our community to help guide us. And that's the only way we're going to fix this.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I know I said I was going to let you go, but I had a conversation with a friend who is a chief today. Matter of fact, he called me and, you know, he was really broken about this situation as well. The Floyd situation, of course, we talked about, you know, Arbery, and of course I want to talk about Amy Cooper, you know, the white woman who's screaming.
Oh my goodness.
We won't get into that. I'll let you go here. But we were talking about all that kind of stuff today. And I'm really thinking that, you know, in connection with Eric Garner, I think the public is really having enough of this. And as we saw in the video, people were telling the officers, get off of him, let him breathe. He can't breathe. He's looking at his nose is bleeding.
All of it.
I think that one day, if not soon, and I would not be surprised if the public sees a situation like that and just massively attacks and just goes crazy because they can't take any more of this. I don't think we're far away from that. So I hope that the suggestions that you've said today, that we're all saying, and that law enforcement listens, politicians listen, right? It's not just police chiefs, but these politicians and district attorneys have to say, listen, knock it off.
National Guard just got called into Minnesota, into Minneapolis. They called in the National Guard. This reminds me of the Rodney King riots and Ferguson, and we haven't learned. This is what I don't understand. We haven't learned.
And not only that, I'm going to let you go. I promise I am.
Yeah.
Rodney King, Ferguson, I'm sure that you read the Kerner Commission, you know, back in the 1960s.
Yeah.
Listen, I got to let you go. I'll have you back on.
No
problem. We continue this with this all day, all night. But thank you so much for coming on. Great conversation. I'm definitely going to have you back. So keep your phone and your email handy. You will definitely be coming back. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate this. We could talk for hours on this issue. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, I'll talk to you again. Take care.
Okay, bye.